Hey, I'm nice.
Oh my goodness.
Hi, guys. Hi,
hello.
Nice to see you. Thanks for coming over.
For the final episode of the season, we wanted to do something a little bit different. So back in episode one, we explained that we were inspired to start Embrace Race in the first place because of experiences we had at our kids' preschool. We were both on the school's diversity committee, and while the committee would meet about policy and school events, we always found the side conversations we were having about race and kids especially helpful, and we wanted to make space for them. That's how we came to form Embrace Race.
But about the same time that we were launching Embrace Race in 2016, we started having a group of friends who also had young kids over to our house to talk about how race was playing out in our lives and in our parenting. It was amazing. The conversations and community we've built locally have been so vital to our parenting that we decided to end this season there, where we started.
Welcome to the Embrace Race podcast,
a show about how to raise kids who are thoughtful, informed, and brave about race.
I'm Andrew Grant Thomas, a Black man born in Jamaica on the 4th of July. I'm also a co-founder of Embrace Race and a dad raising two kids.
And I'm Melissa Giroux, a Black and white multiracial mom to those same two kids. I was born to a mom from Quebec and a dad from Dominica and co-founded Embrace Race with Andrew.
For this episode, we are sitting down with some really good friends and neighbors who've been on the Embrace Race journey with us. They're all parents. One of them is also an educator. And we're having an unfiltered conversation about our efforts to guide kids around race.
You'll hear lots of kids and race stories. We're going to talk about our parent and educator wins and fails, what we've learned, and what we're still trying to figure out. We share what gives us hope about today's kids, and we invite you to join us and have your own get-togethers. Hi, everybody.
Hi.
Hey.
So glad you're here, and we brought all of you together because...
We're fun.
Because you're fun. Because you're fun. Because you've been
so before we jump into our conversation, some introductions. Sitting in our living room, we have three dear friends. To my immediate left, we have...
My name is Dana Kadish, and I identify as a Jewish white woman, and I've been in early childhood education for the last, 28 years.
We've known Dana for 12 years. She was the admissions director where we sent our kids to preschool. She has since become the co-head of that school, and it was there that we started having the group conversations that inspired us to create Embrace Race.
I'm co-head of school for a small independent school that serves children ages 3 to 12. And the essence of our mission is based on social and environmental justice. And that's where I met you.
We know it well.
Yeah, and very early on, what we loved about the school and about Dana in particular, introducing us to the school, was we asked, what are you guys doing around race and identity? And Dana said, we're working on it. We have a lot to do. Come join us and do it, which wasn't what everybody said. You know, a lot of people said, oh, we got that. Or what do you mean? There are no issues, right? So the humility really mattered.
What's interesting is it's 11 years later, and we're still working on it. We're still working on it. So that's just worth noting.
Yeah.
And to Dana's left, we have Kama.
My name is Kama Ennis. I am a friend. We met at a little shindig that another friend had when you all first moved to the area. And I remembered one of my first things was like, oh my gosh, this is great. There's another Jamaican person here. I'm a Jamaican American immigrant, though I grew up outside of Philadelphia. I still sort of claim all the cultures that I've had the privilege of being part of. Though I did have some strong feelings when I learned that our younger daughters had the same name, and I thought I had claimed the name Lena for Amherst, but you know, it's
not
okay.
Not only both Lenas, but both Beans.
Both Beans, right?
And like the same age.
What? Yep. Same age, same grade. Beans.
Yep, and now they go to the same regional middle school.
There was a little tension to begin with, but we worked through it.
We worked through it. Yeah. It was worth it, too.
It was hard between us, but the kids liked each other.
They did. Mm-hmm. They still do. My work has been in healthcare and medicine for the better part of forever, as a physician in this community and currently still the physician in this community, though no longer in the emergency department, which was my home for about 15, 20 years, but now working in a different clinical area and also working on a project called Faces of Medicine to, you know, share the stories of Black female physicians and hopefully increase our numbers so that we can have an impact on health equity outcomes, which are not okay.
Mm-hmm. And I do want to say, Kama mentioned fellow Jamaicans, so we were both born in Jamaica and both came to this country at an early age. And that moves my spirit.
Yeah.
Right. That's like, that's my people right there.
Absolutely. You know,
the cultural hybridity, the all of that mm-hmm. stuff.
Mm-hmm. Kama, how old were you?
I was almost three.
Okay. Little.
Very little, but huge extended family in Jamaica. My mom is one of 11. My dad is one of 12. So I still have tons of cousins there and aunts and uncles. And, you know, we went back every year or two when I was a kid. Mm-hmm. So I very much feel like that's part of me and my kids do as well, which has been really pretty awesome to see them develop that connection and own that place.
And then last, but definitely not least, to Kama's left, we have Farah.
I can't believe you didn't call me your people, too.
Andrew?
You are my... Come on now.
All right. So my name is Farah Amin, and I am Bangladeshi-American. I was born in Pakistan, grew up in India, lived in Bangladesh for a year and a half, and then came to the States when I was 22 or 23, and I've been here ever since. But I... somehow still call myself Bangladeshi. How did I meet you guys? I met you actually, even though we had kids at Crocker Farm, the elementary school, I met you through my husband, John, who's white. And I say that for a reason, because we're going to talk about race. When he was a trustee at the library and you came and there was an issue over where about the Tintin comics at the library, which are now on a higher shelf. And then I guess we connected at the school and at the pool in the summer. Yeah.
And I started doing political work with Farah a little later around
2016
around school integration project.
Farah is a writer and editor. She's also a trustee for a public library, which is an elected position. So we'd love to know, who are the kids you're likely to have in mind as we have this conversation?
In my case, I've got 110 students that I have in mind day to day, but I also have all children in mind. But it's also interesting because I'm thinking, even though I was just saying to Farah, I have young adults as children now, I'm still thinking about it with them. And I'm still in conversation with them. I have a 19-year-old and I have a 22-year-old. So, you know, I'm in a really different place at this point in terms of parenting. I'm a empty nester. And yet, you know, I mean, you all know this, like the parenting is still daily. So I'm still spending a lot of time engaged in important conversations with my kids around race.
Yeah, I mean, my kids are 15 and 12, both girls, and they are both Black biracial. My ex-husband, with whom I have a really great co-parenting relationship, is white. And when I say white, I don't mean just white. I mean like Mayflower white on both sides. Like both of his parents go to the Mayflower. So he's got like, they've got that, and then they've got the Jamaican immigrant experience. And so they have this combination of ancestries to reconcile. And so we talk about things very openly. We talk about things in a way that, you know, my parents and I didn't necessarily have these conversations because as immigrants, that wasn't necessarily on the table. And the transition into being in the U.S. came from their perspective as immigrants who grew up in a predominantly Black country where Black people held all roles. And so
90% Black.
Right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so they raised us in a certain, my sister and I, in a certain way, but without necessarily having conversations that they didn't think applied to us. And so I found out about things more experientially, say. And I wanted to be really transparent with my kids about where they are, what their background is, and how they're growing up, and how they are perceived as light-skinned Black girls, essentially, and what that means in this country, in this culture. So I'm thinking about them, and I'm thinking about all the other kids who have these multitudes of contributions to who they are and how they present and have to integrate all of that.
It's funny, you know, I hadn't really thought as we were assembling this group, I hadn't put together that, yeah, there's a lot of multiracial family happening, right? Dynamics happening here. Mm-hmm. Farah.
So my daughter is 14. She's Bangladeshi and she's dark skinned. And it's strange because growing up in India, I didn't really, like, I don't think I was as, I almost want to say obsessed with race until I moved to the US. Mm. It became all consuming once I became a parent. But I mean, India's different and Bangladesh, I mean, it's, there still is this thing about color, right? If you're lighter skinned, you're beautiful. Or
colorism, yes, everywhere.
Everywhere. And it's like, you know, you see someone who's darker skinned or something and someone will say, she's a little dark, but, you know, she'd be, if she were lighter or whatever. The funny part was when we adopted Sophia and we were bringing her, when we brought her home, there were people, you know, sometimes making ridiculous remarks like, you know, once she moves to the U.S., she might get lighter or...
Seriously?
Yeah. Ouch. I mean, just or why, you know, she's cute, but she's... I mean, all this stuff. And sometimes I wouldn't tell my husband because I knew it would make him really angry. So, and I think when Sophia was really little, I noticed racism on the playground. And I've talked to... You know, Melissa and Andrew a lot about this when she was younger. But now I think I have talked so much about it that she just doesn't want to talk about race. Mm. I mean, now she has a more mixed group, but there were a lot of times when she was the only brown kid, you know, in like especially in elementary school in a group of four or five white girls. You know, it just made me uncomfortable because I didn't feel like the other kids had the same stuff going, you know, they're all like, they were all prepubescent at that point. I mean, you're dealing with that and you're dealing with race. And as she grows older, like things like going in a store, because she would talk about things like, you know, this friend of mine stole something from the store. And I'd say, you know, you really have to be careful, 13-year-old kids.
Yeah, yeah.
Because you are the brown kid and everyone else around you is white. So, mm-hmm. You know, I don't want to think like that, but I think about it all the time.
Yeah. Melissa, do you want to say, hopefully folks know a bit about our kids because we talk about them a fair bit, but do you want to say something about our kids?
So, I mean, first of all, Andrew identifies as Black, right? Black American.
Yes. Yes, it's true. It's true. Yes, I do.
Yeah. Jamaican-American, but really identifies as African-American. I identify as multiracial, Black, white. I'm often perceived as white or mixed race. Our kids are, I would say, light and medium brown skin, 13-year-old and 15-year-old. And just the other day, we were talking about colorism at the middle school about these boys saying, I prefer light-skinned girls, you know, and just the way people kind of put out their standard and kind of as a light-skinned or medium-skinned person and as girls, as Lena identifies as a girl, you have to be careful not to feel, you know, validated by that.
Yeah.
You know
what I mean? It is amazing, right? So, yeah, Farah, you're talking about back home and how people might talk about your daughter and, you know, she's beautiful, but she's dark and that's too bad. It is amazing, right? I mean, whereas with race and racism, at least a lot of people feel they need to be really cautious in expressing that stuff, right?
Right.
But colorism, not just in South Asian American communities or South Asian communities, but Black, I mean, all of them.
Yeah, in Jamaica, my girls would be called brownin, which, you know, puts them in a different potential social category, which is just, you know, it's absurd because I'm still their mom, right?
Where
I'm
they
still
can work at the bank in the front.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And that is.
I have extended family members who would, who've said very freely, oh, I wouldn't date a dark skin boy.
Absolutely.
Right?
No,
like, straight up. So, as you know, we started Embrace Race in 2016. When our kids were 5 and 8, more or less, right? They're 2.5 years apart. How old were your own kids? To what extent was race on your radar? What your kids were learning about race, your own sense of responsibility for how to teach them about race, ethnicity related things. What were you thinking?
So 2016, of course, was an election year.
Humbly and gratefully
accept your nomination
for the presidency of the United States.
He called this woman Miss Piggy, Then he called her Miss Housekeeping because she was Latina.
Wrong.
That is absolutely
wrong.
Proved over and over again.
And when those election returns came in, my kids were about the same ages as yours, so around 5 and 8, I think, at the time. And I woke up saying, I'm going to go to work late today because I have to be the person who tells my kids about this election.
Donald J. Trump will become the 45th president of the United States, defeating Hillary Clinton in a campaign unlike anything we've seen in our lifetime.
And I have to tell them a lot of words that they're going to hear or that they will be more likely to hear now than they would have had the election gone differently. And we sat in the car and I went through a list of, honestly, every racial slur I could think of for all different races and ethnic categories. Like the first time I heard racial slurs directed towards me, I was in second grade and I didn't know what they were. I didn't recognize the words. I hadn't heard them before. So I went home and I said, what does this word mean? And I wanted my kids to understand, one, what it would mean if somebody said those words to or about them. And also if somebody said those words to or about somebody else in their presence, mm-hmm. so that they could call it out. Because I didn't want them to hear another slur and tolerate it and think that it was okay. It triggered a lot in terms of having conversations earlier than I thought I was going to have to, given where we live, which is, you know, perceived as a relatively open, safe place. But that's kind of how 2016 shifted my conversations with them, or just accelerated my conversations with them.
You said an interesting thing, Kama, at the end there, which was, you know, first you refer to it as a shift, that the dynamics around the 2016 election and, you know, what was being said sort of shifted your thinking about what your kids would need to be prepared for. And then you said, well, no, maybe it accelerated, right, your approach. So I want to bring that to you, Dan, and you, Farah. Like, yeah, did all the stuff, whatever it is that you associate, right, with the election of 2016, and we know that it was super racialized and overt and all of that, but did that kind of shift the work you thought you needed to do?
I think the thing about 2016 Trump, I was terrified. I mean, not even about having a brown kid or being a brown person, but the whole thing about his anti-Muslim agenda. Mm-hmm. Because the one thing that I kept thinking was like, my mother's never going to be able to get a visa to come here. Mm-hmm. And that shifted everything for me. And I think I was hyper aware of being Muslim more than because I had gone through this so many years of being pulled aside because I didn't have an American passport till 2010, I think. And I had been in the country 20 years or something. You know, we listened to NPR all the time when Sophia was little, and there had been that story about Trump saying that, you know, he was going to go around shooting people on Madison Avenue. I don't know if you remember.
Oh, yeah.
And
if Sophia that would be okay. You'd get away with it. Yeah.
And Sophia didn't have, you know, she had no contacts and she was 6. And we said something like, you know, don't talk about it in school, because we were like, oh, should we not have been listening to this, you know, with our 6-year-old? Because, you know, it's not funny, because if Trump is elected, Nanu, my mom, will not be able to visit us. And Sophia went to school, and how that translated for her was she was talking to a friend who was Mexican-American. I got a call from school and the teacher said, this incident happened, and it turned out she was talking to her friend, and she said, if Trump is elected, your family's going to go back home. Sophia had no idea what she was talking. Mm. You know, the kids started crying. I mean, it was just like this whole picture, like, oh my goodness, you know, now we have to worry about race, we have to worry about religion, we have to worry about, you know, and we all know that.
On and on.
That was,
I have all these different threads running through my head, because I remember actually distinctly the impact on the school, right? So I remember having a special meeting where we brought teachers together to sort of try and get our heads on straight around, like, we have our work cut out for us. And also to just hold how upset everybody was, and perhaps naive we had been, right? So, and I'm thinking about, you know, the work you had to do, Kama, and I had to do sort of slightly, of course, different work, which was, first I had to break it to my kids that we didn't have the first woman president, which I naively really thought was going to happen. So that felt really hard. But then for us, I think the conversation became more complex around our privilege and what it meant to have that privilege and what our responsibility was around that privilege and how we couldn't be complacent, right? Because of the responsibility that we held. And then the other key thing was talking to my white son about when he snuck out. We caught him. We caught him sneaking out. But the best part was, you know, we were tracking him on our phones. He had no idea. So we were like, Sam, where are you? And he's like, oh, we're walking around the neighborhood. We could literally see them like booking it back from downtown Amherst, right?
Sweet.
In the middle of the night, it's like 2 a.m. And they're running back from Amherst and lying the whole way.
That's hilarious.
And then when, you know, it was hilarious. And my husband and I are like watching this unfold and like laughing, not laughing. But then later was the like, so Sam, you went downtown with yourself and several kids of color and your black best friend. And I just want to say the impact of being downtown in the middle of the night and being mischievous could be completely different for your best friend than it is for you. Yeah. And then we proceeded to have a whole series of conversations when kids are on JOL, when they have their learner's permit. So they, what is that, junior license? I don't even know what the acronym is, but anyway, where they're allowed to drive, but they can't drive their friends. They broke this rule all the time and would sneak around doing this. And I kept saying, you realize that the impact of you breaking that rule versus potentially a black boy breaking that rule can be completely different. Yeah. And even here in sunny Amherst, right? Safe Absolutely. Amherst, I need you to take this into consideration. So anyways, there are all these different, I'm having all these memories of all these different moments where I was trying to provide that scaffolding.
Does Sam get that? Or did he resist that?
No, he did get it, but they teased me about it. You're being overprotective. You're being a neurotic mom. Calm down. It's fine. I mean, he really did get it. Don't get me wrong. He was very attuned to it, but he and his friend would laugh me off a little. And I'm imagining, and I imagine then, that it was like too much.
Yeah, because you don't want it to be real.
No one right? wants that to be real.
Right.
So it's easier to just say, okay, Mom, we got it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But yes, they got it. They did get it.
But what was so interesting, just hearing all of your conversations about 2016 or about that presidential election, was this question of sort of privilege and of how different people are treated really came up with our oldest, right? When they were 7, and it was 2015 before Trump was elected, and we really didn't think he was a viable candidate. Mm-hmm. And they were talking about it at school, and Rio came home and couldn't sleep at night because they were very nervous that Trump was going to put up a wall and our family was going to be separated by the color of our skin. And we sort of thought, well, oh, come on, he's not going to. At first, I literally said he's not going to be president, but then I said, but
and
what
to
if
be
he is?
Clear, you alluded to this before, but there are 4 of us and 4 different skin
four
tones,
different skin
right?
Tones. Yeah.
4 different shades of brown,
yeah,
as it
and
were.
So that felt, and so I said, well, what if he is, let's play this out. Like, who are people really targeting with the wall, you know? And who are your people and how do we organize, right, to be safe? And so then we had to have a conversation about documentation and who was being targeted with the wall. And it was not us, right, with that particular thing. And we had this privilege, right, among other privileges, where we had to stand up for people who were being targeted, right? And it did become, because he was saying so many things at the time, that it felt like, you know, who's safe? Like, we really have to band together people of very different identities and understand we're positioned differently. And sometimes we have privilege and sometimes we don't. And we have to be aware of that and stick up for each other.
Yeah.
So I wonder, just looking back on sort of the growth or just how, or the environment, you know, I think what you guys would say about how your parenting or your teaching, your curriculum has changed since, you know, Floyd and certainly the election of Donald Trump before that and so many other incidents.
And Dana, when we met you, you were director of admissions. Mm-hmm. Now, for the last several years, you've been co-head of school. Mm-hmm. And the school itself has been on, you know, a very thoughtful journey,
yes.
right? Digging deeper and deeper into this work of how to help kids engage with this in a healthy way. So Yeah, you really.
Yeah, where are you now?
I mean, this is like a whole story, and it would take so much time to really unpack it fully, but I would say we've changed significantly. I think that is a fair statement. And we are unapologetic about our mission and very explicit about the work we do with young children. And that is a key distinction. So when we first started on the journey, not everyone was on the same page. So one of the big pieces of my work that I shifted was every family I meet, as I had referenced earlier, I am naming precisely what their children are going to be learning about. And I make it clear that if you're not on board with that particular approach to education and early racial learning, this probably isn't the school for you. Mm-hmm. And so what's great is that there was a time where there was a tremendous tension around being that explicit for so many reasons, but also the fear that we would lose families, right? I mean, the bottom line is it's an independent school. It's not a classic private school. It's not a wealthy school. And we are not typical in that way. However, we're powered by tuition. So if you have a mass exodus of families, you're in trouble, right? So, yeah. You know, it's political, right? And you're constantly having to try and be diplomatic. At one point, I finally said to a colleague, well, if we go down, we go down with integrity. Mm-hmm. And I meant it.
Absolutely.
I meant it. And I was like, we're going to do this. And we are. And the cool thing is enrollment is way back up. And I think part of that is that clarity and that commitment, but also being so thoughtful, right? There's so much learning that had to happen. And Andrew, I know you and Melissa with Embrace Race, one of the key things that you have said that I have repeated to numerous families is if we don't teach it, children are going to make their own assumptions because of the water we swim in the greater world. And so we have a job to do, and this is what we're doing here at the school. A couple other key things that I think are worth noting. Our school is represented by 47% kids of color. And one thing I feel sheepish saying it is that when I started to work very intentionally on diversifying the school, we put the cart before the horse. And what I mean by that is that we were not yet learned enough about what it would mean to then have a truly diverse community in this greater community. And so we've had to do a lot of work. We've had to do a lot of learning, and we've had to think really carefully about every aspect of our program. And we've done that. Had some really hard conversations about what it truly means to belong. What does it feel like? What do we need to do as a community to create a sense of belonging? How are affinity groups valuable in an institution? Why do we press for those, even though some families have felt excluded from them through time? The curriculum, the content itself, talking about race with three-year-olds, creating social stories to talk about race, to talk about oppression and fairness with three-year-olds. So we're building that foundation, right? So then as children move through the school, we can grow more sophisticated in our thinking. I think also, though, here's a tricky one. There was a lot of emphasis in teaching hard history, but in doing so, are you eradicating like Black joy? Are you eradicating all the amazing people who have made incredible progress in the world, who are people of color? Like, what are we focused on? It's not that we didn't do both, but it became imbalanced. Mm-hmm. How do we put that back in balance, right? We don't want to just have a narrative of only oppression, right?
Right.
That would be detrimental as well. So those are just a couple of examples, yeah, but it's ongoing.
Sounds
right.
Easy.
Yeah, it's so easy.
But that goes back so to easy. What, that also goes back to what Farah was saying about what are the supports, you know? Mm-hmm. I mean, that's what we're trying to do with Embrace Race is create supports that we need, that other people need, and knit mm-hmm. the resources together. But what I have found, and Farah, you were saying this as well, that, there has been sort of progress in some areas that really helps the work. Like there are more books, mm-hmm. you know, there are more movies you could mm-hmm. use. There are more TV shows. There are more people who think that this work's important, you know, who explicitly think it's important. I mean, there's also pushback. Kama, how have things changed for you sort of then and now in terms of how you're parenting, how you're feeling supported or not around race?
I would say that, you know, compared with 8 years ago, I guess it's now, I don't like that math. It feels like number's a little too high. But I think the conversations have evolved, right? I mean, the kids can handle different levels of content, different levels of challenge. You know, if they say something, they repeat something that they heard in school, I can dig into that a bit with them. If they don't acknowledge their own privilege in certain aspects, so I can dig into that. When they come with me to Jamaica, because we still go every couple of years, or when they go with their father to a beautiful part of the country that has very little diversity. When he goes back to where he grew up, they have to reconcile with that as well. And so we talk about all of these things, I think, really explicitly, and they are not afraid of the conversation, which makes me really happy. And they can see things when they talk about like different hair textures and hair colors. And, you know, one of my kids, when she was in preschool, at one point came up to me and said, "Mama, I wish I had straight yellow hair." And it's like, first died a little inside. Mm-hmm. And then had to talk about like why her wonderful curly hair was wonderful. And like, "Mama's hair is even curlier than yours. And it's in these, you know, it's in this particular style. I've got locks. And so what does that mean? And what is different hair? And how does different hair come about? Because all of the hair of their cousins on one side is blonde, and all of the hair of the cousins on the other side is everything from, you know, is multiple textures, multiple colors. But I think at this point they see a lot of it. A lot of that early foundational work and just having plain conversations, I think, has paid off. And so they point things out to me when we're at different places. They, for better or for worse, like when I was a kid, my mom, one of the lessons I did get when I was a kid was when I was a teenager, you know, catalogs would come to the house because it was the 80s and that's how that went. And we would go through like the catalogs. I'm like, "Oh, I like that," or "I like that." And she'd say, "Look at the people in these photos. Like, do you see anybody black in any of these photos?" And I was like, and I would flip through and I would see nobody. And she'd say, "Then they don't want our business." Mm. And so we wouldn't get anything from that catalog. And so when I related that story to my kids multiple times, and so now they go into a space and they see where they are welcome. They see where they are not. They can call it out, and they don't personalize this. They see it as a systemic flaw. They understand that they are like the bomb, and it's not, they don't internalize that, which I think is huge. It's one less burden for them to work through. They still have to work through the crap, but they don't have to work through whether or not any of it is because of who they are, truly who they are.
Farah, I'm wondering how much of what Kama just said is resonating with you.
I keep thinking about the one thing that's at the back of my head and that I've been trying not to think about. And now I'm mad at you guys because now I'm thinking about it. But so when Sophia was little, like, she hated the color of her skin. Like, when she was really little, she wrote a letter to Obama because one day she asked John, she was like...
John is your husband?
Yeah, my husband, John. She said, "Dad, so President Obama is black, right?" And John was like, "Yeah." She must have been probably 5 or 6. And she said, "Well, so I'm darker than him, aren't I?" And she said, "Yes." And she said, "Well, then how come I'm not black?" So John said, "Why don't we send him an email or a letter?" And they crafted this letter and sent it to him, and just, you know, how she was thinking this.
John is so can do.
Yeah. And awesome. There was a letter back from the White House, but it was sort of more, you know, from Obama, but about how, you know, it's kids like you who are changing the world. I mean, didn't address the fact that, of course.
I'm sure he penned it.
Of course he did. But all that to say is, she doesn't like the color of her skin, right? As she's been growing older, and one of the things she's pushed against for many years is being South Asian. And it's partly to do with how she's being raised. But, you know, and we're raising a confident young woman, I'm hoping. But it still bothers me because she pushes against that. And
That's bothersome. But what about the skin color issue?
So it's so funny because you said foundation and I was thinking about makeup, because one of the struggles has been no makeup until you're 13. Then we realized it was a losing battle because she was getting makeup from friends who were white girls. And with these, I'm sorry to say, but these horrendous colors that did not work with her skin tone at all. Mm-hmm. And then I had to give in. And sometimes John, my husband and I would talk about it. And, you know, sometimes she'd find some kind of like highlighter or whatever. And one day I looked at her skin and I was just like, what'd you put on your skin? Because it just looked lighter. And so John and I were talking about it. And I think that still there's some of that going on that she's partly maybe trying to cover up the blemishes, mm-hmm. you know, young kid, hormones, eating crap all the time. But I haven't been thinking about that for a while because I'm talking about sex and boys now all the time. But that's still there.
So sorry.
Yeah, no, I know. It's just like, right. Why do I have to have these conversations? My mother never had these conversations with me, mm-hmm. which is why I'm having these
conversations.
Exactly.
That's
right. Look how you turned out.
Yes, we're going to talk about this.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm dying because I don't want to look at her while I'm talking about all this stuff, yeah. but I'm doing it. So because I'm so close to it and I would get into these battles with her, so I would have John talk about it, you know, with her about being, you know, you're Bangladeshi American or, you know, I don't know how to approach it right now because there's so many battles you're fighting with teenagers and you just want to be on their good side, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And rounding up this conversation and really just wondering, sounds cheesy, but what are the things that give you hope in terms of this generation, you know, that we're raising and the many generations that you're raising and that Embrace Racers are raising and how they'll approach race in the future? Like, what are the things, what are the stories you could tell that make you think, oh, they're going to be okay. Like they're preparing for a future that is different from our present and they're going to be okay.
I could weep over it because the kids set me straight every day. The thing is, the kids are okay. It's the grownups. The kids we're raising right now doing this work, they're amazing. Like Embrace Race gives me hope. My school gives me hope. Comma, your project gives me hope. Like there's great work happening right now. So I do legitimately feel optimistic when I hear you engaged with your children in the way that you are, Farah. But yeah, the kids are okay. We can't let up. We just have to keep pushing the work forward and we have to stay in conversation and we have to keep going. Mm-hmm. And I will say the work can be really exhausting, right? It's hard work. Yeah.
And doing it in community.
And doing it in community. I'm so glad you said that because that's everything. I don't know if you folks know Loretta Ross, but she's an amazing professor and she talks a lot about calling people in rather than calling people out. And I'm a huge fan of hers because I'm like, you know, you can spend all the time you want calling people out, but it may not get them to the table. I want people at the table, right? So I think a lot about her work and calling it in. And the other thing Loretta Ross talks about is you got to find a way to do it in community and you got to find a way to find joy in the work because if you don't, it's not sustainable. So this, what we're doing right now, this is good. This is finding joy in the work, mm-hmm. right? Being with your people and having these conversations and feeling inspired. That's good stuff.
I think that's super encouraging and inspiring.
And Dana, you know, I wonder how you feel about going even a bit more broad than find the joy.
Mm.
You know, find the solidarity.
Mm.
You know, certainly mm-hmm. joy is part of that. And a lot of it is hard. And it's different when it's hard together.
Mm-hmm.
Right? It's like it's hard for me. It's hard for mm-hmm. you. We can talk about that. You know, sometimes we really can shed tears together. We mm-hmm. can laugh together. Sometimes it's hard,
mm-hmm.
but it's different when, you know, it feels like there are a whole bunch of us on a very similar journey supporting each other through it, mm-hmm. you know, then, oh, I'm isolated.
Yeah.
This is my own. Am I the only one out here feeling this way? Mm-hmm. And what we find is, yeah, we certainly do the work we do. You know, just to give you a very quick example, back in December 22, we did a national survey of parents of kids 13 and younger. And one of the amazing takeaways from that is literally 4 in 5 parents said, we need to do this work. If we took our cues only from what news media tell us, mm-hmm. right? It's images and headlines about angry parents storming school board meetings and saying, no, we can't talk about gays and lesbians and LGBTQ people in general. We can't talk about race. We can't talk about all these things. And saying it in the name of quote unquote parents' rights. Right. Which implies that lots of parents feel this way. But actually, the vast majority of parents don't feel this way.
Yeah.
Right? And they want their schools to be able to talk. I mean, there's a range of opinions, to be sure. It's not that there's one side and everyone, right, is just chomping at the bit, waiting for an opportunity. But a lot of people would much rather see us do this work than not do this work.
And that survey was not Embrace Racers. It was 1,000.
A nationally representative, yes.
Right. Some of them knew Embrace Race, but most of them didn't.
I mean, the fact that you all started Embrace Race in 2016 and, you know, not knowing how it would go, not knowing if there would be support, if there would be interest, and that it has just grown as it has is amazing and wonderful that people are invested in learning and want to do better for the next generation of kids. They want to go to that uncomfortable place and do the work so that it can be better down the line. So I'm inspired by my kids, by their friends. When I hear them interact with each other, it's hilarious. And yes. They just, you know, they're just able to feel comfort in conversations that I didn't. And when I read some of the things that they put together for school, I'm like, girl, you're deep. Like, I didn't know you got that. But, you know, here, let's do this. I think that, you know, I love that finding joy in the work because it is hard. Mm-hmm. But I think that it's, you know, obviously it's necessary still. And the thing that I try to enforce for my kids is holding two truths simultaneously. Like, people think and do horrible things. And most of them aren't horrible people. They've just grown up with very different influences, very different exposures than you have. I'm a sort of assume best intentions, but take notes. So like,
collect that data.
Right? So I think that they have some of that in them as well, though they can sometimes be a little like, meh, they suck. Like, yes, and let's figure out how to bring it back a bit, which is painful and hard sometimes.
I mean, holding the nuance, adults have a hard time with it, right?
Exactly.
Like that's just the thing. How can we hold the nuance?
But they're in it and they're doing what they can. And I think that's super encouraging.
Hope, Farah. You're always the person I turn to for hope.
Because, you know, I'm sort of raising my kid as, you know, expect the worst. You'll be surprised. She actually said that the other day, and I felt like, oh my goodness, I never said that to her. Has she just like absorbed that from living with me? Hope. I feel in some ways that we're lucky that we live where we live, though I feel for all of this town's, you know, we don't see color. People see color all the time, and it's not just color, it's socioeconomic, and we've talked about this a lot. I'm impressed that Kama's daughter is letting her read what she writes, because I get a lot of, you know, no, you can't, I don't want to show you this. Part of it is because being an editor, I spend a lot of time saying, oh, maybe you want to fix that spelling, or you want to, but I feel like they talk about so many different things at school these days. The last night I was getting a complaint about how is it going to help me in the world to know how the colonies were formed? So there is that as well, right? Yeah. I just feel like as a parent, I can give my kid the tools. I know she's strong, but the world is not an easy place. And I have to say that I spend quite some time letting her know that, you know, we don't bubble wrap her. Like, I'm just hoping that we can talking, you know, and I just resent the fact, Andrew, that you haven't brought us here for conversations in a long time, because I miss this. Is it COVID?
Yeah.
You guys don't like us anymore.
It was a thing.
Yeah, it's COVID. A whole different conversation.
Yes, I know.
Yeah.
Melissa, okay.
Yeah.
What gives you hope?
You know, having a strong community, knowing that to have authentic relationships, we really need to not expect joy, joy, happy, happy, but like we have to get through and know each other. And that authentic, you know, closeness with people like you, with people not like you is really worth it. And I think I'm really impressed with our kids. Dana, you were saying that the kids teach you every day.
They do, yeah.
And I feel that way about our kids, and particularly about intersectionality or even our own things. You know, if very early I used to say about colorism, I'd say the black or the berry, the sweet or the juice. And they would both say, oh yeah, you hate yourself, mom. You're pretty light, you know? And
check
so, it's, yeah, check. Or Lena would say, yeah, post Floyd, you can't really say something openly racist at school, but you can still say you run like a girl, you know? So things like that, they really do just push you in great ways. And they're having, because they're having the conversations, they're just really sophisticated about
them.
So
sophisticated,
you know? So it makes me really, hopeful, as does, you know, being in contact with you guys and with like just a lot of people through Embrace Race, who I'm learning a lot from, who are doing amazing things. I mean, it's hard not to be hopeful when you have so many people doing amazing work.
Yeah, that is, to me, I mean, both with Embrace Race and with all the sort of race work I've done over a long period of time, that's one of the best parts, right? Is just being, that it allows, it puts you into contact with people who are smart and passionate, care every bit as much as you do about this stuff and are doing things about it. If you weren't doing the work, you'd have no reason to know that they're out there, that they're working so hard. And so that starts from, yeah, other parents, right, and educators and folks. I mean, so here's a thing that I think there's no reason a lot of people would know, but we do because of the work we do. There are a lot of psychologists, an increasing number of pediatricians. There are a lot of researchers, social science researchers, parents, educators, children's media people, who are thinking, how can we do this better, right? Philanthropy folks, journalists. Think about 10 years ago, now after every, you know, typically horrible thing that happens around race in this country that's high profile, there's a spate of articles right around how you talk to your kid. That wasn't true 10 years ago, certainly not 15 years ago. Mm-hmm. That's a sign, right? Mm-hmm. There's a demand for this. It's seen as important. We created this collectively, and we can create something different. And more people, I think, are sort of bending to the task of, let's create something different and better that we feel really good about our kids inheriting. And our kids, in turn, will take it further and farther, right? So just the possibility alone of doing better is more than enough to get us out of bed and feeling hopeful.
Yeah. Thank you so much, you guys, for this conversation, for coming over. We have to do it more and more.
It's an honor to be a part of this.
You just heard from our friends and neighbors, Farah Amin, Kama Ennis, and Dana Kadish. Andrew, that felt great.
It really did. And that's why community building is at the heart of the work we do at Embrace Race.
Mm-hmm.
Sitting and talking with really thoughtful people who are also trying to do this kids and race work is so helpful.
It's magic. It's not that we solve the world's problems or always get solutions to our own problems in these conversations. It's more that we feel seen, accompanied, and inspired. And I think you could hear the joy and connection we felt in that conversation too.
Yep. And we would love to have more people feel that same joy and connection. So if you've been following this first season of the podcast, you know that in previous episodes, we push back pretty hard against some of the big myths about race and kids by digging into how kids actually learn about race. And we shared strategies for how to do the work of raising kids who are thoughtful, informed, and brave about race. But what you might not know is that for each of those episodes, we shared some really good reflection questions and resources. We encourage you to listen to the episodes, to get your friends and family to listen, and then, really important, get together to talk it through. Check out the show notes for resources that'll help you host your own conversations.
And the best way to stay in touch with all our offerings and happenings at Embrace Race, including our plans for season two, is by subscribing to our newsletter. We have a lot going on. Go to embraceRace.org, scroll to the bottom of the page to sign up.
The Embrace Race podcast is hosted by me, Andrew Grant Thomas.
And by me, Melissa Giroux. Our senior producer is John Asante. Our editor is Megan Tan.
Our engineer and sound designer is Enrico Benjamin. Our consulting producer is Graham Griffith. Graham believed in this podcast from early on, and that's a big reason why it came to be.
Special thanks to Team Embrace Race, Robin Deutsch Edwards, Andrea Huang, Tamara Montes de Oca, Christina Ruzinski, and Mariam Zahid.
And a huge thank you to our two kids who motivated us to make this podcast and to the Embrace Race community.
Subscribe, rate, and review our show on Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcatcher. That really helps us.
And for more resources related to today's show and other topics about race and kids, please visit us at embracerace.org.
Thanks for listening. We'd love your feedback as we plan for season two. Send that to our email, hugs, H-U-G-S, @embracerace.org.
Thank you.